Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 transitional year resident that's ultimately going into radiology. This will be the 102nd episode of the Divine Intervention podcasts. And in this podcast, I know for episode 100, I had a clutch micro podcast. I'm going to call this the clutch cancer podcast. I mean, obviously, cancer is not clutch for the patient. I'm just calling this a clutch podcast because it's oriented towards getting you like many questions right on the USMLE exams. So let's just go ahead and jump right into it. So what if you get a question about like a kid that's presenting with like ataxia and they tell you that on imaging, they find like a necrotic mass in the cerebellum. And let's assume like it's in the middle of the cerebellum, so like around the vermis area. What kind of tumor are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about like a medulloblastoma. Okay, that's the classic way it presents on the USMLE exams. Although if you saw an answer that says juvenile pilocytic astrocytoma, you should probably go ahead and choose that one first over a medulloblastoma because they can have very similar presentations. That is why on MBMEs, they almost always never put both as answer choices in the same question, because actually a pilocytic astrocytoma is the most common, very high yield, is the most common brain tumor in kids. And again, it usually arises in the posterior fossa, usually in the cerebellum. Okay, so just sort of keep those two things at the back of your mind. But usually for some reason, they go after medulloblastomas on the MBME exams. And remember that the pilocytic astrocytomas, right, they contain those eosinophilic fibers. Do you remember what those are? I really hope you're thinking about those Rosenthal fibers, right? And then what if they give you a question about a person that has like some brain mass and they tell you that it's attached by like some dural tail, like, or they tell you that it's a parasagittal mass, or they tell you that the mass is kind of like stuck to the meninges. What kind of brain tumor are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about a meningioma, right? Remember, meningiomas, they tend to attach to the, to the meninges, so they can attach to like dural folds. That's why they can arise parasagittally, right? And what's the classic histologic finding in meningiomas? I really hope you're telling me the classic Samoa bodies, right? Okay. Now, what if you get a question about a patient that presents with like bilateral hearing loss and they tell you that this person has a history of some genetic disease? What are you thinking about? Again, I hope you're thinking about NF2, right? And remember, those people tend to get bilateral acoustic neuromas, right? Or bilateral acoustic schwannomas. Those tend to arise in the at the cerebellopontian angle. Okay, so that's something you definitely want to keep at the back of your mind. And remember that these bilateral acoustic neuromas, they're essentially diagnostic of neurofibromatosis type 2. Remember, that's a chromosome 22 problem versus NF1, that's more of a chromosome 17 problem. And in NF1, right, remember your cafe au lait spots, remember your skin neurofibromas, remember the association with the optic nerve gliomas, right? And those people also have an increased risk of acoustic neuromas. But acoustic neuromas, you really want to think more about NF2 on your exam. Okay. Now, what if you get a question about like a farmer, and they tell you that this farmer, you know, he over the last few months, he's had like these lesions on his like forehead that are kind of like rough. They're kind of like rough, and they tell you he's a farmer and he works a lot like in the hot sun, and they're like multiple lesions on like his face, on his hand, I mean on his forearms and stuff. What kind of lesion are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about actinic keratosis, right? Actinic keratosis, remember, sun exposure is the biggest risk factor. But the most likely outcome for these farmers is it will likely resolve, right? But remember that there is an association with the future development of squamous cell carcinoma of the skin. Actinic keratosis is a precursor to squamous cell carcinoma of the skin. Now, what are the classic, I guess, skin findings and people in lesion that may tell you that this may be melanoma? Right, so remember your A, B, C, D, E, right? So like your A for asymmetry, right? So the lesion is not like super well circumscribed. It's not like perfectly symmetrical. And then the B, right, is for the borders, right? And then the C is like the color variation. So like it may be dark brown here, maybe black here and all that stuff. And then the D is the diameter, right? So it's like usually like greater than 6 millimeters. And then the E is the evolving, right? So like the thing is beginning to like change character, change appearance. That sort of makes you worried about a melanoma, right? And remember that for melanomas, the biggest prognostic factor, right, is the breast load depth, right? It's one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind on MBMEs. And the thing is, remember that there are certain like unusual spots that melanomas can arise, right? So they can arise like under the fingers, I mean under like the nails, right? That's like the that's the one that's called like the acral lentiginous kind. Tends to arise like more in African Americans, so that's like the classic demographic that you will see given on the USMLE exams. So that's something I'd really like you to sort of keep at the back of your mind as you're taking your test. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a person that, you know, comes in, has this lesion on his face, and, or they may tell you that, or they may describe it as a lesion that has like pearly gray papules, or they tell you that, oh, it has like telangiectasias and is above the lip. What kind of skin cancer are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about like basal cell cancer of the skin, right? That's the classic way that presents on MBMEs. Okay, and remember, right, if you're thinking about squamous cell cancer of the skin, since I'm talking about it already, remember that marjolaine ulcers, right? So like ulcers that just seems to not heal, right? And they usually associated with like burn wounds and all that crap. You really want to think about a squamous cell cancer. A marjolaine ulcer is basically a squamous cell cancer of the skin. Okay, now, what if you get a question about a kid that over the last like 3 months, this kid has had like bone pain and he kind of hurts and he's been having like these fevers, and then they show you like an x-ray of the involved extremity and you see like this sunburst pattern. What kind of cancer are you thinking of? Right, I hope you're thinking about osteosarcoma, right? And the thing is, osteosarcoma, it's actually not that hard to detect on MBMEs, right? Because they usually give you like some kind of risk factor. They give you the classic imaging finding, right? So remember, osteosarcoma has the association with the Codman's triangle, right? So that's one you want to know. Don't forget your sunburst pattern, right? And then some risk factors, right? They can give you a question about like a child that they say, oh, a newborn, instead of having a red reflex on fundoscopic exam, the newborn has a white reflex, right? If you see the white reflex, right, you're thinking about retinoblastoma. And then they can ask, this patient is at increased risk for what in the future, right? Obviously, it will be osteosarcoma, because whenever you have that RB gene mutation, right, first you'll be diagnosed with retinoblastoma in childhood, but that certainly does increase your risk of osteosarcoma in the future. Okay, now, other things that increase your risk of osteosarcoma, right? So one is Paget's disease. Right, because remember, your bone is sort of growing in a kind of like a disorganized fashion, right? So you can get into trouble with that in the future. And then another one is this drug. It's like a PTH analog that you give in a pulsatile fashion to build bone, teriparatide. Remember, you're basically giving a growth factor or like a stimulating factor for bone. So that can certainly increase your risk of osteosarcoma in the future. So you sort of want to keep that at the back of your mind. Okay. Now, what if you get a question about a kid and they tell you that this kid, it's like, I don't know, I'm like 2 years old or whatever, and they tell you that this child has like hypertension and has like a flank mass, and then they tell you that they perform imaging and like a CAT scan of the abdomen, and they see a mass that's like crossing the midline, right? It's like a flank mass, but it's crossing the midline and it contains calcifications. What kind of tumor are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about a neuroblastoma, right? So remember, it's a mass, it's a flank mass that crosses the midline and it's calcified, right? That's the classic way it presents on MBMEs. And remember that it can also present as a posterior mediastinal mass, right? Because it's a tumor of a neurogenic origin, right? So calcified crosses the midline. Contrast that with a Wilms tumor that it's a flank mass. The child can present with hypertension, but it will not be calcified and it will not cross the midline on MBME exams. And remember, right, your Wilms tumor is associated with the WAGR complex, right? So like the Wilms tumor and aniridia, GU anomalies, and like the mental retardation, which I guess these days is called intellectual disability. So I'd like you to keep that at the back of your mind for tests. And remember, right, that on histology, for these are neuroblastomas, right, you can actually see like the Homer, right, pseudo rosettes. They're kind of like, it's almost like circles of columnar epithelium that's surrounding like an empty space. That's kind of how it looks on histology. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. And remember that there's this oncogene that is kind of associated with neuroblastomas like NMEC, okay? So that's something you want to, again, keep at the back of your mind with MBMEs. And remember that neuroblastoma can actually be associated with something called opsoclonus, myoclonus syndrome. So they may describe like a little kid with like weird hand movements and a little kid with like weird eye movements. If you see like weird eye movements, weird hand movements in a kid, and you really want to think about opsoclonus myoclonus syndrome, you need to go ahead and screen that kid for a neuroblastoma, okay? It tends to show up in very, very young kids on MBMEs. I guess while we're on that topic, right? So if you see a kid with like coriform arm movements, and they tell you that this kid had a sore throat like back in the day, you want to think about a sequelae of a rheumatic fever, right? It's called a PANDAS syndrome, right? So it's like the pediatric autoimmune neurocyte disorder associated with a strep, right? So basically, if you see coriform movements in a kid, you want to think about PANDAS. It's a sequelae of a group A strep infection with a rheumatic fever. Okay, so let's keep going. So what if you get a question about, I don't know, let's say you get a question about some patient. They tell you that this patient has like episodic headache and hypertension. Like he just has like this encephalopathy that sort of seems to occur periodically. And when he has that encephalopathy, you check his pressures and it's like crazy high, like I don't know, like 200 over 150 or some crazy number, right? What kind of tumor are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about a pheochromocytoma, right? Pheochromocytoma. Remember, those tumors arise from the adrenal medulla, okay? So like the chromaffin cells of the adrenal medulla. So under those circumstances, so those cells, right, if they ask you like what kind of receptor will be found on the surfaces of those cells, I really hope you're thinking about the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, because remember, your adrenal medulla is basically a kind of modified postganglionic sympathetic neuron, right? So it should have nicotinic acetylcholine receptors on its surface. And remember that pheos, right, you can check like the level of urinary or serum metanephrines, they'll be elevated, right? And then before you take those people to surgery, remember you want to block alpha receptors first before you block beta receptors, right? So that you don't have like unopposed alpha 1 stimulation and get like a massive hypertension and die, right? So it's just one of those things. You block alpha first before you block beta, kind of similar to the whole cocaine overdose crap. Person overdoses on cocaine, you don't want to give a beta blocker because they can have an opposed alpha and get hypertension and die, right? So you usually don't want that. That's usually not a great outcome. Although on MBMEs, right, if a person has cocaine overdose, you probably want to go ahead and give them a benzodiazepine first. But if you don't see a benzo as an answer, you can give an alpha blocker, right? So like phenoxybenzamine or phentolamine. Alternatively, you can give an alpha beta blocker, right? So like carvedilol or labetalol. So just, again, keep those options at the back of your mind. Now, and remember that pheos, right? What's like this genetic syndrome that appears to be associated with pheos, right? I hope you're thinking about your MEN syndromes, right? If you want to be a little more specific, your MEN2 syndromes, right? So like MEN2A, 2B. I remember MEN2A, right? That's where the people have like the medullary thyroid cancer. They have the pheochromocytoma. And then they can also have the primary hyperparathyroidism. And I remember that primary hyperparathyroidism that you find in the MEN syndromes, it's parathyroid hyperplasia that causes it, not parathyroid adenoma. So here's the thing. The most common cause of hyperparathyroidism from a parathyroid problem is a parathyroid adenoma, okay? But specifically in the subset of patients that have the MEN syndromes, the most common cause, very high yield to notice, the most common cause of hyperparathyroidism is parathyroid hyperplasia. So hyperplasia of the parathyroids, not an adenoma of the parathyroids. That's actually kind of high yield to know. And then remember MEN2B, right? That's where they have like the medullary thyroid cancer, they have the pheochromocytomas, right? And then they have the mucosal neuromas, right? So like the lip neuromas. And they also have like this Marfanoid habitus, right? So remember, if you see a Marfanoid habitus on your MBME exams, they're kind of like three things you want to think of, I guess, right? You want to think about like MEN2B, right? And these other associations. You want to think about Marfan syndrome, right? Remember, Marfan syndrome arises from like a fibrillin defect. Those people tend to have like their lenses dislocated upwards, right? And remember, it's an autosomal dominant disorder, right? And it's a chromosome 15 problem, right? And then these people with Marfan syndrome, remember, they tend to get other problems like mitral valve prolapse. They tend to get like aortic dissection. They can get aortic regurge. They can get many different problems, right? Pectus excavatum and all that crap. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind, right, with Marfans. And then another thing that can cause a Marfanoid habitus on MBMEs is hyperhomocysteinemia, right? So those people may have like an MTHFR deficiency. So I believe it's like methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, or they can have a CBS deficiency. So like a cystathionine or beta synthase. If you listen to my biochem videos, you'll see I basically describe the pathophys behind many of those problems. Okay, so since we're talking about cancers, right, so we talked about how the medullary how a pheochromocytoma can be associated with MEN syndromes. Remember that pheo is also associated with, NF1, right, so neurofibromatosis type 1. That's actually a high-yield concept you want to keep at the back of your mind. So, other associations, right, for pheo, right? So I talked about the MEN syndromes. Since I've talked about the MEN syndromes, it probably makes sense to talk about the medullary thyroid cancer, right? So medullary thyroid cancer, what's the tumor marker for medullary thyroid cancer? That's calcitonin, right? And if what's like the special stain that's used for medullary thyroid cancer? Right, it's Congo red. Remember, if you see amyloid, right, in the around the thyroid gland, you really want to think about medullary thyroid cancer. The amyloid basically is just from deposits of a calcitonin associated with the tumor, right? So remember, the medullary thyroid cancer, it arises from the C cells, right, that kind of surround the thyroid. Okay, now all the things you want to keep in mind with medullary thyroid cancer. Basically, if a patient has a history of like MEN2B or 2A, you want to go ahead and resect their thyroid, because it's not a matter of if they will get medullary thyroid cancer. It's more a matter of when they will get medullary thyroid cancer. So those people need to get a prophylactic thyroidectomy, because their risk of developing medullary thyroid cancer is about 100%. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a person that has like a neck mass, and you take a biopsy and you discover it to be papillary thyroid cancer? What is the classic risk factor they must have been exposed to that increased their risk of getting that? I hope you're thinking about like neck radiation, right? So classic thing, right? So like they tell you about like a patient that got like chest or neck radiation for like, I don't know, like a Hodgkin's lymphoma when they were teenagers, and then they present with a neck mass and they say like, oh, what's the most likely, blah blah blah, right? Think about papillary thyroid cancer. It's actually very high yield to know this, especially for step 2 CK and step 3. The biggest risk factor for papillary thyroid cancer is a prior history of radiation to the anterior chest wall or to the neck,
Okay, and remember that papillary thyroid cancers, right, on histology, they tend to have those fancy schmancy sarcoma bodies, right? So that's something, again, you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. And then, since we're sort of kind of talking about thyroid cancers, right, remember that papillary thyroid cancer, it loves to metastasize through the lymphatic system. Contrast that with a follicular thyroid cancer that basically does not metastasize through the lymphatic system. It's more like a hematogenous mets, right? So that's actually, again, a high yield factor you want to keep at the back of your mind. And remember that many of these thyroid cancers, right, they tend to present as like cold nodules, right? So remember, obviously, right, on the NBMEs, if you see like a nodule in the thyroid, first thing you want to do is go ahead and check the TSH, right? If the TSH is super low, that tells you that the nodule is hyperfunction. It's a hot nodule, right? Very unlikely to be malignant. But if the TSH is high or normal, right, that tells you that, okay, dealing with a cold nodule here, right? Then basically your next steps in diagnosis or management for both kinds of nodules are completely different, right? So if, for example, if the TSH is super low, you're like, okay, crap, this is a hot nodule. You're like, okay, good though, it's not a cancer. So your next step will be to get a RIU scan, right? Like a radio iodine optic scan, right? So you get those scans, you see a single focus of like uptake, that's like a toxic adenoma. You see like multiple discrete areas of uptake, that's like a multinodular goiter. You see like diffuse intense uptake throughout the thyroid. Then you're thinking more about Graves' disease, right? Then contrast that with a cold nodule, where your next step in diagnosis or management, right, will be to go ahead and get like an ultrasound of the thyroid gland with a biopsy, right? So just again, keep those things at the back of your mind. Okay, so I think I've sort of said enough with the thyroid cancers. Now, what if you get a question about a kid that they tell you that this kid has like, you know, like he's having like a ton of seizures, and they tell you that they get an EEG during one of these seizure episodes, and let's assume it's a kid less than a year old, and they tell you that they see like a super chaotic, disorganized pattern. What kind of genetic syndrome do you think I'm talking about? I hope you're thinking about tuberous sclerosis, right? Tuberous sclerosis. Remember, it's a autosomal dominant disorder. And what kind of seizure does this kid have? That's West syndrome, right? Or like your classic infantile spasms. I remember that that responds pretty well to ACTH. If you don't see ACTH as an answer choice on your NBME, go ahead and pick a vigabatrin. Okay, vigabatrin. That's another thing that may show up. That's like a GABA analog used to treat seizures. And again, this kid has tuberous sclerosis. Remember that in tuberous sclerosis, they can have like the subependymal, like a hematomas. And remember the other malignancies, right? Even if, although many of them are benign, that are associated with tuberous sclerosis, right? So like the cardiac rhabdomyomas, right? They can have like the renal angiomyolipomas, right? So like a tumor containing blood vessels and muscles and fat, right? So those are classic associations you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then there is one more. This is one of those things that if most people saw it on the NBMEs, you probably get it wrong. There's this tumor that's actually found in a lot of people with tuberous sclerosis, a brain tumor. It's called SEGA, so like a subependymal giant cell astrocytoma. That's actually another pretty classic association with tuberous sclerosis that pops up occasionally on the NBMEs. And that chaotic pattern on EEG I'm describing for West syndrome, remember that's the classically described hypsarrhythmia. Right, hypsarrhythmia. If you see that boss phrase, you really want to pretty much stop reading the question. Think about tuberous sclerosis. Think about West syndrome or infantile spasms. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a patient? Let's assume it's a female and she's like postmenopausal and she's having like visual difficulty, like tunnel vision sort of deal. And she's having like galactorrhea, or they may present it as a younger female that's having like infertility problems. If you see that, like visual field deficits, infertility, sort of see that cluster, right? You kind of want to think about a prolactinoma, right? Remember, it's a type of pituitary adenoma. Remember, it responds very well to like bromocriptine, cabergolin. That is, I'll say like 99% of the time on the MBMEs, that's the best treatment. Don't go straight for transsphenoidal resection. Most prolactinomas resolve with dopaminergic therapy. Remember, another name for dopamine is is prolactin inhibiting a factor. Okay, and right, pituitary adenomas, right, they can compress the optic chiasm, they can cause the bitemporal hemianopsia. So the people will get a tunnel vision. So basically, they will lose the left visual field and the I don't want to mistake myself. This is something I'll have to draw to make sure I'm not making mistakes, but don't really have time for that right now. But yeah, they get a bitemporal heteronymous hemianopsia. So basically, they don't, it's not like they lose the left visual field in the, you know what, yeah, let me let that go. Just bitemporal heteronymous hemianopsia is something I have to draw out, and that will take me a while. I don't want to delay this podcast because this podcast is probably going to go on for a little longer than I planned. Okay. Now, right, so pituitary adenomas, remember pituitary adenomas actually associated with MEN1, right? So like the pituitary adenomas, parathyroid problems, pancreatic problems, and the most common kind of pituitary adenoma, right, is a prolactinoma. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a child that has like visual field problems, or they give you a question about a child and you see on imaging they find like a calcified mass, what kind of tumor are you thinking about? That's a craniopharyngioma, right? Craniopharyngiomas, don't forget the embryologic tying there, right? So like the Radke's pouch, something that shows up quite commonly on exams. And remember, it drains like that motor oil fluid, right? When you're doing like, when you get like a pathology specimen. Okay, now, what if you get a question about a lady, right? And they tell you that over the past month, she has lost a ton of weight, is having high fevers, one of her breasts is like super enlarged, super tender on exam, and it looks like edematous. What kind of tumor are you thinking about? Right, I hope you're thinking about like an inflammatory carcinoma, right, of the breast. Just awful, awful, awful prognosis. Basically, it's a kind of infiltrating a ductal carcinoma that has kind of like invaded the dermal lymphatics, right? So that's the classic we will present on exams, right? So please don't confuse that with like mastitis, right? Mastitis is usually like a unilateral breast problem. Shows up like related to like recent delivery of a child, right? So like around pregnancy delivery time. So that's like the classic way it presents on exams. And remember, right, Staph aureus is like your culprit there. I want to go ahead and give like a nafcillin or dicloxacillin on the USM list for that. I don't think I've ever seen vancomycin ever be correct as a treatment for mastitis. So just don't pick vancomycin. Just pick dicloxacillin, oxacillin, or nafcillin. Those are your anti-staphylococcal penicillins. They cover MSSA pretty well. And then, what if they give you a question about a lady has like an eczematoid change of her nipple? What kind of disease are you thinking about, right? Paget's disease of the breast, right? Remember, right, this usually is associated with like some kind of underlying or infiltrating a ductal carcinoma. Okay, so what if you get a question about like a 25, 26-year-old female. She tells you that over the last month, she's found a lump in her breast, and the lump is like movable, and it's like firm. What kind of tumor are you thinking about, right? It's a fibroadenoma, right? Usually, you just go ahead and reassure the patient. If they're asking you for imaging, you can do an ultrasound of the breast because the patient is less than 30. But yeah, there'll be a fibroadenoma. Grows with the menstrual cycles. Usually it's usually pretty benign, right? So for these patients, you can reassure them, do a physical exam in like a few weeks. It may have resolved by then and whatnot. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. But don't forget, if a lady is less than 30 and she's presenting with a palpable breast mass, don't go for a mammogram first. Go for an ultrasound. Because remember, if you're less than 30, you have like pretty dense breasts. So mammogram is not super helpful under those circumstances, at least on MBMEs. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a lady? You know, they tell you that she's at 10 weeks gestation, but her uterus kind of measures, like from the pubic symphysis to the fundus, kind of measures like 20 centimeters. That's like size greater than dates, right? And then they tell you that you perform an ultrasound and you see like an ill-defined mix of like hypo and hyperechoic structures in the uterus. What are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about like a molar pregnancy, right? So like a hydatidiform mole. Remember, right, if you do like pathology on those, you see like the grape-like clusters, whatever. Classically on ultrasound, right, they describe that snowstorm appearance, but they know that everyone has memorized snowstorm, so they usually don't put that crap on MBMEs anymore. Snowstorm appearance, that's why I said, ill-defined mix of hypo and hyperechoic crap. You see that, think about a hydatidiform mole. Remember, right, there are two kinds of those moles, right? There's like the complete mole, and then there's the incomplete mole. The incomplete mole, even if it sounds, you're like, ah, incomplete sounds bad. No, the incomplete mole is actually better than the complete mole. The incomplete mole, right, it's the one that has like the, it's like usually like triploid, so it's like 69XXY or whatever. That's the one that actually contains like some fetal parts, right? And it's the one that's less likely to progress to a choriocarcinoma. Contrast that with a complete mole that usually does not contain any like intact or fetal parts. It's usually diploid, right? So it can be like 46XX, 46XY, blah, blah, blah. And this complete mole actually has a higher risk of a progression to a choriocarcinoma, right? And remember, choriocarcinomas, don't forget your tumor marker. It's like your classic beta HCG. And if they describe a lady that, you know, kind of has like had a recent history of like a molar pregnancy, and then they tell you that she's presenting with a shortness of breath, and they ask for your next step in diagnosis, you want to go ahead and get some kind of chest imaging, right? So like a chest x-ray, because remember, the most common location of a choriocarcinoma mets on MBMEs is the lungs, right? And remember that these people, if they're asking for like a management option, you know, go ahead and put them on methotrexate. It's that fancy schmancy inhibitor of dihydrofolate reductase. That's also a DMARD, okay? It's used as the drug of choice in the treatment of choriocarcinomas on MBME exams. Okay, now, what if you get a question about a patient and they tell you that her mom, for morning sickness, she used like a drug that has been discontinued. That was discontinued, like, I think in the 80s or whatever. I wasn't born. I certainly was not born then. And then they tell you that she presents with, like some kind of vaginal cancer. What kind of exposure are you thinking about, for starters? I hope you're thinking about DES, right? So, like, diethyl estilbestrol. Remember that increases your risk of clear cell adenocarcinoma of the vagina. Because really, like DES, basically what it does is like it sort of makes some of your Mullerian duct like epithelium kind of like hang around, because usually they sort of like disappear from the vagina, like embryology wise, but if they sort of hang around and then you then have like some risk factor that makes you hyper estrogenic, right? So let's say you're obese, remember like that aromatase that you find in all these adipose cells and all that crap, that can basically make those Mullerian structures that persist in the vagina from DES exposure to sort of undergo like hyperplasia and then turn into like adenocarcinoma. Because remember, usually on MBMEs, vaginal cancer is squamous cell cancer, right? And remember HPV as your classic risk factor. But if you see like adenocarcinoma, especially like clear cell adenocarcinoma of the vagina, you want to think about a DES exposure. It's a very rare kind of vaginal cancer and has that very strong association. And then, what if they give you a question about like a 67-year-old female? They tell you that she's been having like abdominal fullness, early satiety. And then they tell you that they perform like imaging of the abdomen, right? So like a CT abdomen pelvis. And they find like a ton of ascites. Defined omental kicking. That's a boss phrase you're looking for. Basically, if you see the word omentum measured, right? Extensive ascites, omental kicking, and all that crap. What are you thinking about? What kind of cancer are you thinking about? That's ovarian cancer, right? That's ovarian cancer. Ovarian cancer has just awful prognosis. I always feel very bad whenever I find out about a person that has ovarian cancer, because it's probably one of the worst, if not the worst, malignancy in females. So ovarian cancer, remember again, right? Classically produces like nasty ascites, omental, because it spreads throughout the omentum. That's the classic presentation on MBMEs. Remember your CA125 tumor marker. And ovarian cancers, though, right? They could present it in like multiple flavors on MBMEs, right? So, for example, they could tell you about a patient that has like an ovarian tumor, and then they tell you that this person is having like shortness of breath. And then they tell you that, oh, they perform chest imaging and they find like blunting of the costophrenic angles on the right. What kind of syndrome are you thinking about? Right, that's a Meigs syndrome, right? Remember, it's like a right-sided pleural effusion in the setting of an ovarian mass. Think about a Meigs syndrome. And then what if they give you an ovarian cancer and they tell you that this person has like almost like myoclonus or like new onset AFib, or I don't know what else. Or they tell you that this person has like lead lag on, so like lead, so like the eyelids, so like lead lag on exam, right? I hope you're thinking about like a stroma ovarii under those circumstances. Remember, stroma ovarii, they tend to contain it's like an ovarian mass that may contain like functioning thyroid tissue, right? And those can cause basically like hyperthyroid signs, right? So that's one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then in the ovarian cancer world, don't forget your teratomas, right? They can contain like multiple tissue types. They can have like teeth. They can contain like hair. They can arise in the ovaries, especially like in a younger person. Think about teratomas. And remember, teratomas, unlike the neuroblastomas that show up in the posterior mediastinum, your teratomas show up in the anterior mediastinum on MBME exams, right? And then what if they give you a question about a lady that has a ovarian mass, and then they tell you on histology they find some mama bodies? What kind of tumor are you thinking about, right? That's a serous cyst adenocarcinoma of the ovary, right? And then I'll just mention this just in case you saw it on a test. Well, this is probably more for step one. But if they tell you that, oh, they see an ovarian mass in a lady, and then they perform like histology, and you see like tumor cells surrounding a blood vessel, what kind of tumor are you thinking about? And I'll give you a hint. This tumor makes AFP as its tumor marker. That's like an endodermal sinus tumor, right? Sometimes they call it a yolk sac tumor, right? These things I basically described are your classic Schiller Duval bodies, okay? So just something to keep at the back of your mind. And then don't forget, right, that men, right? You see like a 20-something-year-old guy for the last few months. He has like a painless mass in his testicle, right? That's a testicular cancer. Most likely going to be like a seminoma on MBMEs, right? And again, remember, seminomas, if they show up in the mediastinum, those germ cell tumors, think about an anterior mediastinal mass. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has been having like early satiety, severe epigastric pain, and then they tell you that they find like the person's like stomach is not moving, basically, and then they tell you that they also see like an ovarian mass on imaging, and then you do pathology and you see like signet ring cells. What kind of tumor are you thinking about? Right, that's a Krukenberg tumor, right? It's like a gastric carcinoma that has potentially metastasized to the ovaries. So, you know, I just keep these things at the back of your mind on MBMEs. Okay, now what if you get a question about, let's see, about a guy that has worked in the textile industry, or a guy that has been treated for a malignancy in the past with cyclophosphamide, and then he's presenting with like hematuria, presenting with weight loss, and then they ask for your next best step in diagnosis. What do you want to do? I would really hope you're thinking about like a cystoscopy with a biopsy, right? Remember, these people basically have bladder cancer. Remember cyclophosphamide, right? It has this It has this, it can cause a hemorrhagic cystitis, right? Because it has this breakdown product. I'm just trying to remember what it is. I know you can prevent it with Mesna. What is this breakdown product? Just give me a second. Sorry, again, this is one of these podcasts I'm given from my memory. Breakdown product of cyclophosphamide. Well, I'll think about it as we go along in the podcast. If it comes to mind, I will mention it. But cyclophosphamide can cause hemorrhagic cystitis. So for these people, you basically want to think about getting a cystoscopy, right, with biopsy. And then you'll find like the bladder cancer, right? Although, even if I mentioned that this person worked in the textile industry, right? So textile industry, you're thinking about like exposure to like a dye, right? So like an aniline dye, right? Remember, those things increase risk of bladder cancer, right? So aniline dye, so working in the textile industry or what's the other thing I mentioned? why am I forgetting things I just mentioned? So working in the textile industry is one risk factor. Another risk factor is exposure to like schistosoma hematobium, right? And then the other risk factor I just mentioned like 30 seconds to a minute ago that I'm not remembering right now. Think about bladder cancer under those circumstances. Although remember, and you want to do a cystoscopy with biopsy to go ahead and make the diagnosis, right? But the thing is, on NBMEs, you actually want to remember that the biggest risk factor for bladder cancer is actually smoking, right? That's something that actually shows up pretty commonly on NBMEs. The biggest risk factor for bladder cancer is smoking. So you want to keep that at the back of your mind as you take your exam. So cyclophosphamide, schistosoma hematobium, and working in the textile industry and exposure to dyes, like aniline dyes, those all increase your risk of bladder cancer, right? And remember, right, the classic things that cause hemorrhagic cystitis on NBMEs, one is cyclophosphamide, which, like I said, you can basically prevent that with Mesna, right? And then there's also adenovirus. Adenovirus can actually cause hemorrhagic cystitis as well. But remember that adenovirus can cause like pharyngeal conjunctivitis, right? So like sore throat and pink eye. You can pretty much stop reading the question on the NBMEs. It's adenovirus. That's it. So let's keep going. But one thing I just, again, it's popped up in my mind is, remember this cancer drug cisplatin? Remember, it's nephrotoxic, and you can prevent that nephrotoxicity with an agent known as amifostin on NBMEs. And so this again just popped in my mind. Cyclophosphamide, the nastiness that causes bladder problems, is something called acrolein, right? And Mesna binds up that acrolein, so you can use that to sort of prevent the hemorrhagic cystitis that's associated with a cyclophosphamide therapy. And don't forget that you also want to like basically irrigate those people's bladder, basically like pour a ton of saline into their bladder so you can decrease the amount of contact time between cyclophosphamide or its breakdown products and those people's bladders. Okay, now, what if you get a question about, let's see, how do I present this? What if you get a question about a patient that has, you check their hemoglobin, it's like, I don't know, like 20, so like crazy high, and then they tell you that they have a flank mass on imaging, and they tell you that this person has smoked for a long period of time, and they tell you that, I don't know, maybe this person has like a right-sided varicocele. What kind of cancer are you thinking about? really hope you're thinking about like renal cell cancer, right? Under those circumstances, right? So it can present like the hematuria, flank mass, and remember that it can produce EPO as a paraneoplastic phenomenon. And remember that renal cell cancer loves to metastasize to bone on NBMEs. It causes lytic lesions, right? Kind of like lung and thyroid cancer. And if you see a right-sided varicocele, right, probably means the renal cell cancer is like metastasized and involved like, it has involved like the IVC, or it has involved like the gonadal vein on the right. So that's why the person is having like a varicocele. Because remember, the most common location of varicoceles is on the left. Because if you remember that fancy schmancy thing from embryology where the left renal vein has to kind of like cross the midline and then join up with the IVC. The left gonadal vein drains into the left renal vein, right? And then the left renal vein has to like cross over, go with the, and then join up with the IVC on the right. So that's kind of like a circuitous route, right? So it's like kind of increases your risk of like stasis and all that crap. So you can get varicoceles with that. So, if you see a right-sided varicocele, right, you want to begin to think about renal cell cancer, because a right-sided varicocele, it's kind of rare, because the right gonadal vein drains directly into the IVC. Doesn't drain into the renal vein, right? It's just one of those, like, anatomy mix and match thingies they can do to people on exams, right? So, again, renal cell cancer can produce EPO in a paraneoplastic phenomenon. That's why the clinical vignette I made up, the person's hemoglobin was like crazy high. And then it can show up as like flank mass, hematuria, all that stuff, hypertension. So just again, keep that at the back of your mind. And remember that it causes lytic bone mets on NBMEs, not blastic, lytic. The things that cause blastic mets on NBMEs are prostate and breast cancer. Okay, but lytic mets, think about renal cell cancer, thyroid cancer, and lung cancer on NBMEs. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a patient that's like in their 50s, 60s, they present with like jaundice, they've had like really bad weight loss, and they present like epigastric pain. What kind of cancer are you thinking about? We're thinking about pancreatic cancer, right? So like a tumor of the head of the pancreas. Remember, on NBMEs, you want to go ahead and make that diagnosis with a CT scan of the abdomen, right? Remember, pancreatic cancer loves to invade like the superior mesenteric artery and all that stuff. And basically, once you have like encasement of a blood vessel, those people are not surgical candidates anymore, pretty much. And then they may ask like, oh, let's assume these patients have like bad itching and bad jaundice, and you want to sort of like palliatively relieve their symptoms, that what can you do? You can basically place like a biliary stent to sort of help the badness, like the bilirubin drain, right? So like you can do an ERCP, place a stent. Pancreatic cancer is bad. And don't forget your tumor markers, like your CA19-9, right? And if they gave you like LFT anomalies on an NBME, right, in a patient that has pancreatic cancer, those patients will have like really nasty elevations in their ALK FOS, right? And then they will have a direct hyperbilirubinemia, right? Because remember that pancreatic cancer sort of causes like a cholestatic pattern of LFT anomalies, right? Because it's an obstructive lesion, pretty much. Okay, now, what if a person has like colon cancer? What's the most likely organ it will metastasize to on NBMEs? That's the liver, right? That's the liver. Colon cancer goes to the liver on NBMEs. It can go to many other spots, but it goes to the liver on NBMEs. That's the thing I want you to keep at the back of your mind. And since we're talking about the liver, right? Remember your hepatocellular carcinoma. Remember, right? Anything that increases your risk of cirrhosis, right? So like chronic Hep B, chronic Hep C. There's this weird thing called thorotrast that occasionally pops up, but that's more like step one further. Or if you eat like a certain kind of like mushroom with those aflatoxins, or if you have like hereditary hemochromatosis, remember Bronze diabetes with that. Or a person has like Wilson's disease, right? That copper problem where they have the like the weird spots in their eye, the Kaiser Fleischer rings. Or if a person has like
what is it called? Let's say the like they have a history of there's this other classic disease. What is it called? It's not hemochromatosis. They've like been alcoholic for long periods of time, and then they have cirrhosis with that. Those can all increase your risk of hepatocellular carcinoma. Remember, hepatocellular carcinoma, it can produce many things in a paraneoplastic fashion, right? So it can produce EPO, right? And remember that actually measuring like the AFP levels, AFP is a pretty decent tumor marker for hepatocellular carcinoma. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for MBME exams. And then one thing I want to keep mention is they may ask you, they may give you a patient and they say like, which of the following could have decreased this person's risk of hepatocellular carcinoma? Actually, getting the Hep B vaccine decreases your risk of hepatocellular carcinoma, because remember that if you get the Hep B vaccine, you basically will not get Hep B. If you don't get Hep B, you cannot get chronic Hep B. If you don't get chronic Hep B, you cannot get hepatocellular carcinoma from chronic Hep B. Okay, so it's a prevent. They can basically frame that as a preventive medicine question on the MBMEs. Now, what if you get a question about, since I've talked about colon cancer going to the liver, remember that colon cancer, right, can arise from like an adenoma. There's like the tubular adenomas, there's like the villous adenomas. Remember that the villous adenomas are villains, right? So they have the higher risk of progression to colonic adenocarcinoma compared to the tubular adenomas. And remember, these are genetic syndromes, right? Associated with like colon cancer. So like familial adenomatous or polyposis. Remember, like it's like autosomal dominant, APC gene mutation. These people, basically, they need to get like a colectomy prophylactically when they're like in their teens or 20s, right? Because it's not a matter of whether they will get colon cancer, it's just a matter of when, right? So in fact, they start getting screened like at the age of like 15, like some super younger age. And remember, right, those people, if they have like a brain mass, you want to think about Torkel syndrome. And then if they have like these soft tissue sarcomas, you want to think about Gardner syndrome. Okay, so APC gene mutation, brain tumors, Torkel syndrome. Remember, like we're in a, you know what? I don't want to offend another religion, so I'm not going to use the mnemonic people used to remember, but think about Torkel syndrome. That's it. You can look up the mnemonic on your own. And then, if they have like soft tissue tumors, like soft tissue sarcomas, think about Gardner syndrome, right? So Torkel syndrome, Gardner syndrome. And remember with colon cancer, right? Remember the adenoma carcinoma sequence. I described the pathophysiology behind this, I believe, in my cell biology podcast. I think they're like in like one of my episode 50 or whatever. But basically, remember the AK53 progression, right? So like you have the APC gene mutation first, and then you have the KRAS mutation, and then after that you get the P53 mutation, and then you progress to colon cancer. That's the adenoma to carcinoma sequence. That's something that actually shows up pretty commonly on step one and occasionally on step three. So that's something you want to sort of keep at the back of your mind. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has they tell you that they have like let's see, let me frame this right. So, bam, bam, bam. Okay, so what if they give you a question about a patient that has, like, a systolic murmur that's heard best at, like, the left lower sternal border, and then they tell you that this person has, how do I put this? This person has, like, they've been having diarrhea, and they've been having like episodes where they have like stridor. What kind of tumor are you thinking about? And they tell you that they have like an abdominal mass. I'll just give you that. And it's in the right lower quadrant. What kind of mass are you thinking about? That's what? A carcinoid tumor, right? A carcinoid tumor. And remember, if you want to screen for a carcinoid, and right, a carcinoid tumor is most commonly in the appendix, right? So right lower quadrant area. So that's why I said that in the vignette I was giving you. But real quick question here, carcinoid tumor, how do you make the diagnosis? What do you do first? I would hope you're thinking about checking like levels of 5-HIAA in the urine, right?
So that's like the classically described MBME, a screening test. And then a few other things you want to know about carcinoid syndrome, right? Why was I saying that this person has like skin lesions? What kind of deficiency am I trying to clue you towards? I hope you're thinking about like a niacin deficiency, right? So remember that carcinoid tumor, right? Carcinoid is a tumor that secretes a crap ton of serotonin, right? Now, the problem is serotonin comes from an amino acid known as tryptophan. So if you have carcinoid syndrome, you're effectively diverting all your tryptophan to making serotonin. In fact, remember, right, serotonin is known as 5-HT, 5-hydroxytryptophan. The thing is, that's not all you need tryptophan for in the body, unfortunately. You also need tryptophan to make niacin, right? I believe that's vitamin B3, right? That's vitamin B3. Vitamin B3, right? So if a person has carcinoid syndrome, they're diverting all their tryptophan to make serotonin, and they are making less niacin. If you make less niacin, you can get pellagra. Remember the four D's of pellagra, right? So like diarrhea, dermatitis, dementia, and death, right? So, I mean, I'm not 100% sure about this, but I'm wondering if one of the reasons people with carcinoid get diarrhea is because of the niacin deficiency, but who knows? Remember, right, carcinoid syndrome, right, you'll present with like the bronchospasm. They can get like right-sided heart lesions because remember the lungs will break down that carcinoid. So they usually do not get left-sided heart problems. They'll get like right-sided heart problems. And usually on the right side, they usually get like tricuspid regurge and pulmonic stenosis. Nice way to remember that is with the mnemonic TIPS. Right, so like TIPS, so tricuspid insufficiency and pulmonic stenosis. That's a classic way that presents on MBMEs. And then these people, they remember that they will not have symptoms until the tumor metastasizes to the liver, right? Because the liver also has the ability to break down the carcinoid products. Okay, so that's all I'm gonna go ahead and say about that. And remember that carcinoid, if you were to show up in the mediastinum on MBMEs, it will show up in the posterior mediastinum. Okay, it will show up in the posterior mediastinum. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has had like a long history of like GERD, and then they present with a mass in the distal esophagus? What kind of mass are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about like an esophageal adenocarcinoma. Remember, that's the most common kind of esophageal cancer in the US, and the biggest risk factor is what? Barrett's esophagus. And don't forget what Barrett's esophagus actually means, right? It's like an intestinal metaplasia, right? So you go from like the squamous cell carcinoma, you go from the squamous cells that are classically found in the esophagus, and then you have a metaplasia to intestinal epithelium, right? So like those, I believe, are like the non-ciliated columnar cells with, so like non-ciliated columnar epithelium with goblet cells. So keep that at the back of your mind. So Barrett's esophagus, biggest risk factor for esophageal adenocarcinoma. Contrast that with other exposures, right? So like achalasia, Zenker's diverticulum, the person drank Drano or lye 20 years ago, or the person, I don't know, like, basically, like pretty much everything else on MBMEs increase your risk of esophageal squamous cell carcinoma. Okay, so adenocarcinoma, basically the only thing that causes esophageal adenocarcinoma on MBMEs is GERD, Barrett's esophagus. Every other thing you see on MBMEs causes esophageal squamous cell cancer, right? So again, keep those at the back of your mind. And right, a classic question that many people for some reason get wrong on MBMEs is if a person presents with dysphagia, right? If a person presents with dysphagia and they have like alarm symptoms, so let's say they have like painful swallowing, so they have like odynophagia, or they have weight loss and all that stuff, your next step in diagnosis is to get an EGD, right? So an esophagogastroduodenoscopy, right? Because you're trying to rule out esophageal cancer. But another classic thing they tend to do to people, especially like on surgery exams, is, they tell you that this person presents with dysphagia. They won't have any weight loss. They won't have any painful swallowing, nothing. So they will have no alarm symptom. But it'll be more than 50 years old. If a patient is more than 50 years old, being more than 50 on MBMEs is an alarm symptom. For those patients, you want to go ahead and also get an EGD and probably get like a biopsy, just again to rule out esophageal cancer. And remember, right, usually they'll have like dysphagia first to solids and then to both solids and liquids. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, doc, like I have a sort of like, I have a, come on, divine, think. I have a weakness in my, like I have difficulty getting out of a chair. And they tell you that this patient has smoked for a long time. And then they tell you that, you know what, that when you keep telling the person, lift your arm, lift your arm, lift your arm, the patient's weakness gets sort of gets better. What kind of tumor are you thinking about for those people? I really hope you're thinking about a small cell lung cancer, right? So the thing I just described is Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, right? So Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome. So remember, if a person has lung cancer, right? Classically, on MGM is there's three that you're thinking about, right? Small cell, squamous cell, and adenocarcinoma. Now, small cell carcinoma is like the poster child of paraneoplastic phenomena on MBME exams, right? So, for example, small cell cancer, right, it can cause Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, right? So, Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, that's a paraneoplastic phenomenon that arises when you make autoantibodies against the presynaptic voltage-gated calcium channels, right? So presynaptic voltage-gated calcium channels. So you basically do not release a neurotransmitter. So those people basically have like muscle weakness. It kind of presents like myasthenia, but there's a key difference. Myasthenia, those people, if you keep stressing out those muscles, the weakness gets worse. So the weakness worsens with use in myasthenia gravis, but the weakness gets better with use in Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome. The reason why it gets better with use is that the more you exercise that muscle, the more you recruit calcium to outcompete those nasty presynaptic voltage-gated calcium channel autoantibodies, and then the weakness improves. Another way they can actually present that on MBMEs is they can talk about responses to repetitive nerve stimulation. So if, for example, they tell you that a patient has a decremental response with repetitive nerve stimulation on an MBME, you really want to think about myasthenia gravis, right? So a decremental, getting worse response with repetitive nerve stimulation. Contrast that with Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, where they have an incremental response with repetitive nerve stimulation, okay? Because they know gets better with use, gets worse with use, blah, blah, blah. Everyone has memorized that crap. So that's just a very nifty way of them essentially explaining the same concept, but just being a little more confusing on the MBMEs. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then don't forget, right, small cell lung cancer can also produce a ACTH, right? So like ectopic ACTH production. Remember, this is the one that will not suppress with the high-dose dexamethasone suppression test, right? So remember that high-dose dexamethasone suppression, that's like Cushing's disease. So that's like a pituitary adenoma that's making ACTH. But if you have like a failure to suppress with high-dose dexamethasone, then that basically on MBMEs is a small cell lung cancer. And remember, another thing those things can also make, they can make SIDH, right? So that can present with the euvolemic hyponatremia. So remember, those patients will have like a low serum osmolality, right? But they'll have a high urine osmolality. And obviously, the treatment for that kind of euvolemic hyponatremia is a fluid restriction, right? Remember, I already talked about that in one of my medicine videos. Okay, now, and then squamous cell lung cancer, remember, right, that's the one that produces a PTHRP, so it can cause like hypercalcemia. So they can have like the stones, bones, groans, and psychic overtones. Obviously, for those people, you want to go ahead and put them on a bisphosphonate, right? Remember, hypercalcemia of malignancy is treated with bisphosphonates. Although, if the patient is acutely ill and they have like skin tinting and really severe symptoms, your first step in management is to put them on normal saline. Hydration, hydration, hydration is the first step in management of any hypercalcemic crisis on MBME exams. And remember, right, that your squamous cell cancer, your small cell cancer, those arise in the central masses. Remember, they start with an S, right? And don't forget that adenocarcinoma, right, if they give you like a nondescript lung cancer question, like a female or a person that doesn't smoke, think about adenocarcinoma of the lungs. And that tends to arise in the periphery, not in the central part of the lung. And then some other weird things you may see with lung cancer, right? So they may give you a lung cancer question and the person has like facial fullness and all that stuff. And they have like headaches and facial swelling. Think about like SVC syndrome, right? So superior vena cava syndrome. So basically the lung cancer has encased the SVC. So you're not draining all those like head and neck veins. So they can have like the SVC syndrome. And then what if a patient presents with like unilateral, like droopy eyes, and they're not sweating on one side of their face? Obviously you're thinking about a Pancoast tumor, right? So they have like the Horner syndrome, right? So the ptosis, meiosis, and hydrosis. Remember, partial Horner syndrome is associated with a cluster headache, right? So again, it's one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind, where you abort the headache with like 100% high flow oxygen. Okay. Now, I just talked about a myasthenia gravis. What's the tumor in the chest, in the anterior mediastinum, that may be associated with myasthenia gravis? That's a thymoma, right? That's a thymoma. So again, please keep these things at the back of your mind. I promise you, like this podcast, like it's one of those things I can pretty much guarantee. Just take any USMLE exam. You're going to get multiple questions correct from this one podcast. Because basically, I'm just telling you the way these things will show up on these exams. Now, some other things, I guess, with these are lung cancers that you can keep at the back of your mind. They can describe a patient that recently just had like, they say that over the last month he's been having like joint pain and has have like finger clubbing and his fingers are getting big and swollen. And then they ask for the next step in management or diagnosis. You want to go ahead and get some kind of chest imaging, like a chest x-ray, because those people also have a paraneoplastic phenomenon, right? It's called a hypertrophic osteoarthropathy, right? So if you see that, it has a very strong association with a lung cancer. Okay. I think I've said a lot about lung cancer. Just trying to think. Is there any other big malignancy I want to talk about? Cervical cancer, right? Remember, big risk factor is HPV. And remember that cervical cancer, right? You can have like the CIN 1, 2, and 3, and then you go to full-blown cervical cancer. And remember, the most common cause of death, right, is like renal failure, right? Because the tumor can spread and involve the ureters. So basically, if you see a patient that's like in their 40s, and they tell you that they have like a mass in the pelvis, and then they tell you that the person's creatinine is like super high, or they tell you that the patient has like hydroureteronephrosis on imaging, you can pretty much stop reading the question. The patient has cervical cancer, end of story. That's the classic way it presents on MBME exams. Okay, now, remember I just talked about how hypertrophic or pulmonary osteoarthropathy is a paraneoplastic phenomenon associated with lung cancer. One thing I'll just keep at the back of your mind is, this is something that to this day, I have absolutely no clue why this is the case. But hypertrophic pulmonary osteoarthropathy may be associated with hypoglycemia on an MBME. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. In fact, I will tell you this. Many times on MBMEs, they love to test these paraneoplastic phenomena, right? So like EPO production with like hepatocellular carcinoma and renal cell carcinoma, ACTH, SIDH, and Lambertini myasthenic syndrome with small cell cancer of the lungs, PTHRP with squamous cell cancer of the lungs, Pancoast tumor and Horner syndrome, hypertrophic pulmonary osteoarthropathy with lung cancer, right? You can also see like they can frame this as a question where over like a month or a few weeks, a patient just has like all these like black splotches that just shows up all over their skin. You basically want to go ahead and get like some kind of imaging of the abdomen and the chest in those patients, right? That's the sign of lesser trelat or the lesser trelat sign, right? Pretty indicative of a visceral malignancy. Classically on MBMEs, it's either pancreatic cancer or gastric cancer, okay? And one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with gastric cancer is they may give you the boss phrase, a succussion splash on NBMEs. Think about gastric cancer with that, because remember, right, anything that causes a gastric outlet obstruction will cause a succussion splash. Okay, it's indicative of a gastric outlet obstruction. Although they may also put it as like, I don't know, like pyloric stenosis, right? So again, succussion splash, think of anything that can obstruct outflow from the stomach on NBMEs. Another classic paraneoplastic they can give you the they can give you like the velvety lesions like on the axilla, blah blah blah. That's like your acanthosis nigricans, although that probably the most common cause of that in the US is like diabetes and obesity. Okay, we'll think about like a visceral malignancy with that, like gastric cancer and all that fun stuff. Okay, now let's see, is there any other big cancer I want to talk about? I don't know, I feel like I've talked about many of the high yield things. Let's see. Don't forget your shipyard worker and mesothelioma, right? Remember, smoking does not increase your risk of mesothelioma. Remember asbestosis and like your ferruginous bodies. Remember, mesothelioma also has those as sarcoma bodies, right? So remember, sarcoma bodies, papillary thyroid cancer, serous cyst adenocarcinoma of the ovary, meningioma, and then malignant mesothelioma, right? Those all have as sarcoma bodies. So those are your laminated calcifications on NBMEs. And then, remember that, again, I already said that smoking does not increase your risk of mesothelioma. And remember that if people have a history of asbestosis, the most common cancer they get is actually bronchogenic carcinoma, not mesothelioma, okay? And mesothelioma, right, is a pleural malignancy, so it presents with like pleural thickening. It usually presents with like a bloody pleural effusion on NBME exams. So that's something to keep at the back of your mind if I were you. Now, what if you get a question about a patient that has, they have like, let's say they have like risky behaviors, like prostitution, IV drug use sort of deal. And then they tell you that they have like these purple lesions all over the skin. What kind of cancer are you thinking about? That's Kaposi sarcoma, right? Kaposi sarcoma. Remember, it's associated with like KSHV, right? So like HHV-8. So basically a herpes 8. And then what if they tell you about like some immigrant or some kid from Africa and they have like this jaw mass? What kind of cancer are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about like Burkitt's lymphoma, right? Don't forget your 814 translocation. So you have like overexpression of the, I believe it's the c-MYC oncogene, and that can cause like proliferation. I mean, basically like the cells, they proliferate fast, but they die relatively quickly. It's like live fast, die young kind of cancer. And remember the classic starry sky pattern on imaging. I mean, on histology. And then remember, right, what if they give you a question about a patient that has like some kind of hematologic malignancy? And then they tell you that as they're being treated, let's assume, I don't know, like whatever, in the OR or whatever, they become like profoundly hypotensive. They start bleeding from venipuncture sites. So kind of like a DIC picture. What kind of tumor are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about like APML, right? So like acute promyelocytic leukemia. Remember your 15-17 translocation with that. Remember you treat with all-trans arachnoic acid. And don't forget that those things have hour rods, right? And basically, those hour rods can cause DIC. They can activate the coagulation cascade, and then you have like a hot mess, right? So you want to be careful when you're dealing with those kinds of cancers. And basically, right, these hematologic malignancies, they're kind of easy on NBMEs. If you see like a hematologic malignancy, like 6 weeks of like weight loss, fevers, all that crap in a kid that's like in like 5 years old or less. Okay, let's say like 8 years old or less on NBMEs, right? That's ALL, right? Simple as that. Versus the super old person, like 70s, 80s, they come in with like pneumonia and you check their white counts like 80 or like 90,000, some crazy high number. That's CLL. You can pretty much take that to the bank. End of story on NBMEs. And then if you're thinking about midlife, all you have to ask yourself is, do they give you a picture with our rods? That's acute AML. That's acute promyelocytic leukemia, right? But if they don't give you our rods, then it has to be CML, right? Remember CML, your 922 translocation, BCR-ABL fusion protein, and then you treat that with a tyrosine kinase inhibitor like imatinib, right? That's it. So super young ALL, super old CLL. So the LLs, and remember A comes before C in the alphabet. So A, young kids, C, old people, right? People in their 70s, 80s. People in their 50s do not get CLL on NBME exams. Can they get it in the real world? They absolutely can. But on NBMEs, they usually do not, okay? People with CLL on NBMEs like 99.9% of the time are in their 70s or 80s, and they usually present with infection, and they usually present with a crazy high white count that is like 70, 80, 90,000, okay? And then if you see midlife, remember midlife, CML, ML midlife, right? CML, AML, they give you our rods, so A in our rods for A in AML, for A in acute promyelocytic leukemia. And then your CML is the one where they don't give you our rods, right? And they'll have that Philadelphia chromosome from the 922 translocation. And remember that kids with a history of Down syndrome, they have a risk, right, they have like a high risk of getting ALL. Remember this mnemonic that they all fall down, right? So Down syndrome, trisomy 21, ALL. Okay, now, let's see, what else do I want to talk about here? Remember your Eastenberg cells with Hodgkin's lymphoma. And remember, right, these are Hodgkin's lymphomas. So basically, these are hematologic malignancies. They actually have an association with minimal change disease, right? So that's one thing you really want to keep at the back of your mind. Like these oncologic associations with nephrotic syndromes, for whatever bizarre reason, they love, they eat that stuff up on NBMEs, right? So I think of them as the liquid cancers, right? So hematologic problems, right? So like blood problems, like lymphomas, leukemias, and all that crap. Think about minimal chain disease under those circumstances. But if you see like solid cancers, like colon cancer and all that crap, think more about membranous nephropathy, okay? Membranous nephropathy. And remember on NBMEs, this is one of those questions where it's like the 270 style questions where don't forget that membranous nephropathy is associated with like antibodies against like phospholipase A2R, okay? It's one of those weird, bizarre things that shows up on NBME exams. Okay, and so that's that. I'm just trying to think, is there any other big thing I want to talk about? I mean, don't forget this genetic condition that can increase your risk of like pancreatic cancer. They will classically show the people as having like these are like black splotches on their lips. Think about like Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, right? So they get like hematomas in the GI tract, but they can also get like pancreatic cancer with that. Skin cancer, don't forget like xeroderma pigmentosum, right? So those people, their DNA repair mechanisms don't work so well, so they have an increased risk of skin cancer. And then don't forget, right, that if you're looking at like the Hodgkin's lymphomas, right, any Hodgkin's lymphoma that contains more like immune cells, so like more lymphocytes, tends to do better. So like the lymphocyte predominant, blah blah blah, has like a great prognosis. And you want to remember, right, the most common kind of Hodgkin's lymphoma is like the nodular sclerosing kind, right? So those are just like epidemiology like weirdness they can ask on exams. And then if you get radiation to the neck, right, for Hodgkin's lymphomas, that increases your risk of papillary thyroid cancer in the future. And then also one other thing, I know it's like a biostats association with Hodgkin's lymphomas, is this whole concept of a bimodal distribution. That's one thing that they love to put on the USMLE step one. So bimodal distribution, where like you have like this uptick in prevalence of Hodgkin's lymphoma in like teenagers and then like older people. So just keep that at the back of your mind. Again, I apologize. In fact, I'm sorry. This podcast seems kind of disorganized, but I don't know. I kind of find many of these podcasts to be high yield. I just sit down, think about all the high yield things I know from head to toe about like a certain topic, and then I just sort of talk you through many of them. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. Another classic thing that presents with that bimodal distribution on NBM is like fast and slow acetylators, especially with like isoniazid and whatnot. So just again, keep those things at the back of your mind as you study for tests. So let me just think from head to toe. So if you look at the brain, glioblastoma multiforme crosses the corpus callosum, GFAP is the tumor marker, right? And it usually has like a lot of vasogenic edema or central necrosis. That's the classic way to describe it on NBMEs. And then remember, people that have a history of VHL, right? So like von Hippel-Lindau, they can have like hemangioblastomas in the brain. Remember, that produces EPO as a paraneoplastic phenomenon. So if you see like a brain tumor a high hematocrit, think about hemangioblastoma. Remember that VHL also increases your risk of like bilateral renal cell carcinomas, like the clear cell type. And remember that those people can also have like cysts in the pancreas. That's another classic presentation. You can also have like some problems in the temporal bone, but I don't think that's very high yield for the USMLEs. And then if you're thinking about like the Sjogren's syndrome, remember it's association with like a lymphoma of a gland, like the parotid gland or like a salivary gland. And then don't forget like lymphomas of the GI tract with celiac disease. Remember, for those, you check their antibodies against the tissue transglutaminase or the anti-endomysial antibodies. And then don't forget that H. pylori, right? Remember, it like stains positive for silver. This I'm just going to just sort of try to run through relatively quickly. This podcast has gone on for real long, but it's a real high-yield podcast. I just want to make sure I thoroughly deal with cancers in this one podcast, right? So remember, malt lymphomas with H. pylori, remember, it's like silver stain positive, and you can treat it with like triple therapy, so like the clarithromycin, amoxicillin, and a PPI. So remember, like CAP, so clarithromycin, that's a macrolide, 50S inhibitor, A for amoxicillin, and then P for a PPI, right? Or if that doesn't work, you can try quadruple therapy, right? So with like metronidazole, bismuth, tetracycline, and a PPI. Okay, so that's like quadruple therapy for H. pylori. And then remember that thyroid lymphoma is associated with like Hashimoto's or thyroiditis. So that's another thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then if they describe a patient like that's postmenopausal, presenting with like bleeding, you want to think about, the most common cause will be like an atrophic vaginitis, is the most common cause of like bleeding. I mean like it's like vaginal bleeding in a postmenopausal female, but you want to do an endometrial biopsy or some kind of endometrial sampling, right? Because you want to go ahead and rule out endometrial cancer. And remember that tamoxifen, right, does increase your risk of endometrial cancer, because remember that it has estrogen receptor agonist activity in the uterus, but it has antagonist activity in the breast and in the breast. Versus raloxifen, that's another SERM. It has estrogen receptor antagonist both in the breast and the uterus, but it has estrogen receptor agonist activity in the bone, so it can decrease your risk of osteoporosis. And then head, neck, ears, I've talked about schwannomas, neck, I've talked about lungs, heart, right? So remember your cardiac rhabdomyomas with tuberous sclerosis. Also don't forget, right? So like if they tell you about like a diastolic murmur in a patient that has been losing weight, and the murmur seems to disappear when you change position, and the patient has been getting febrile because this tumor actually makes like interleukin 1. Think about a cardiac myxoma. Okay, its most common location is the left atrium on NBMEs. And then I've talked about like teratomas. I've talked about stromal varii. I've talked about neuroblastomas in the posterior mediastinum. I've talked about thymomas and the association with myasthenia gravis. I've talked about stomach cancers. I've talked about Krukenberg tumors, right? Don't forget your linitis plastica, like a leathery water bottle style stomach. I've talked about the succussion splash with those. I've talked about pancreatic cancers. You make the diagnosis with a CAT scan. Don't forget schistosoma, hematobium, and bladder cancer, especially a person from Egypt on NBMEs. Don't forget this bug. It can increase your risk of like a biliary cancer, like cholangiocarcinoma. I believe it's like Clonorchis sinensis. That's like a bug association you want to keep at the back of your mind. Don't forget, right, EBV, right, increases your risk of like nasopharyngeal carcinoma, and also plays a role in Burkitt's lymphoma. Let's see. Don't forget, your cancer is basically of the lower reproductive tract, the HPV association, especially the HPVs like 16, 18, and the ones in the 30s. Let's see. So bowel cancer, appendix with carcinoid, I talked about that already. Cancer under the nails with melanomas. Breast low depth with melanomas. Okay, I think I have said most of the high yield things I want to mention. So as I always do when I conclude every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams. Step 1, Step 2 CK, 2 CS, Step 3, preclinical exams and med school, shelf exams and med school, medicine in training exam, medicine board exams. I do offer tutoring for those. And then if you're a college student that's taking the MCAT or needs biochem, physiology, histology, general chemistry, organic chemistry, whatever, tutoring, I do offer tutoring for all those things, physics even. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or college students applying to med school, so an AMCAS application, I do offer like consulting for those, so like interview prep, help with personal statements, putting your application together. I've done those for many people, and pretty much everyone I've worked with so far has matched. I mean, I was on an admissions committee for a top 2 medical school for a year. So I've sifted through thousands of super quality applications, and I know what gets you set up properly for these interviews and increases your risk of, your chances of matching. So yeah, take that for what you will. So if you have anyone or you need any of these services, feel free to reach out to me. So I wish you all the best in the future. Have a wonderful week ahead. God bless you, and I'll see you next time. Thank you.